Kiddushin, the first volume. We are on page 29B1. Those of you who are just gearing up for this course should get a hold of the book, the first volume of Kiddushin in the Schottenstein Talmud, which is available in any Jewish bookstore. So 29B1 on the right side of the page. We've been reading about the laws of Pidyon HaBen. Remember, we spent our entire session last time discussing the subject of Pidyon HaBen, and I remind you that this goes back now to the Baraita. We read a Baraita that says that the obligations of a, as we understand it, of the father toward the son, where there are such obligations, it is the father who is obliged and not the mother. Okay, and it was there that we took off, because we then learned a variety of obligations that the father has, among them to circumcise his son and then to redeem his son. And we will see the next one will be to teach him Torah. So we're going through a whole list of obligations which were provided for in the Baraita that we had seen in the Gemara. Okay? So, for those of you who have not been with us, we started with the Mishnah on Daf Kaftet Mud Aleph 29a. It is the seventh Mishnah of the first chapter. Kol mitzvot haben ala av. All of the obligations of the son upon the father. Okay? Now we're again 29b1. Tanu Rabbanan. Lifdot et beno v'la'alot la'regel. Let us say that a person has limited resources and he wants to be able to fulfill both the requirement of redeeming his son and to go up to Jerusalem when it is required for people to go up at the pilgrimage festival. Now, when one goes up for the pilgrimage festival, lo yira'e lefanai rekam, you cannot appear before the Lord empty-handed. That is to say, when you go to the temple, you have to bring a sacrifice. Okay? Well, sacrifices cost money. And what if you have limited resources, and just about the time that you're going to go to Jerusalem, it's time to redeem your son? Which comes first? Which comes first? Do you redeem your son, or do you go up to Jerusalem? That's the question here. Pode et beno. So the Gemara says, the Baraita says, he should first redeem his son. First redeem his son. V'achar kach ole laregel. And afterwards he goes up for the festival. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, ole laregel. That's the way the Gemara works. Rabbi Yehuda says, first you go on the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. V'achar kach poded bano. And afterwards he redeems his son. Shizo mitzvah overet. Now we see the reasoning of Rabbi Yehuda. I have the reasoning here. Shizo mitzvah overet. This is a mitzvah that passes. Vizo mitzvah she'eino overet. And the other mitzvah is a mitzvah which does not pass with time. Now, what is it? What is he talking about? Rabbi Yehuda says, olela regel. If you don't go to Jerusalem for Pesach, when you're required to go to Jerusalem, in no time at all, there won't be Pesach anymore. And are you required to go to Jerusalem after Pesach? No, not till Shavuot. Okay? But then that's a new requirement of Aliyah LaRegel. So, in fact, the Aliyah LaRegel, the pilgrimage that is obligatory, is very determined by time. And if you don't do it, then you really won't have a chance to do it. Whereas, after the time, now remember we set last time the time for Pidyon HaBen. The time for Pidyon HaBen is the 31st day of a child's life. Not the 30th day, but the 31st day of a child's life, of the boy's life. Only a boy who has a Pidyon HaBen. So it's the first child who is the first child who is the Yeshua of its mother, and it's the 31st day of that child's life. So if you don't do it on the 31st day and you wait till the 61st day, can you fulfill the mitzvah of pidyon aviv? Yes, you can. Because we also read, what if you don't do it? If your father doesn't do it?
You should do it.
You should do it.
Yeah, but if the 31st, how obligatory, how the 31st day is like the 8th day of the bris, it must be,
No. It isn't, because the Torah says, Mi ben chodesh. Mi ben chodesh.
Okay, so it's a custom 31st
day. No, you have to do it. But you're saying, is it the same as the Brit Milah? No, because the Brit Milah, the Torah says,
exactly,
you have to do it on the 8th day.
Correct.
Here it says, from the 30th day,
okay,
you have to do it. According to the law, you have to do it on the 31st day. But if you don't do it on the 31st day, you have to do it on the 32nd day.
So that's okay?
No. But you can do it. If you haven't done it. Okay? You shouldn't do it lechatchila. You can't do it ab initio that way. But if you haven't done it before, you can do it that way. This still is the mitzvah. And to some extent, that's true also of the Brit Milah. Because, of course, if you haven't done the Brit Milah on the 8th day, you have to do it on the 9th day. If you haven't done it on the 9th day, you have to do it on the 10th day, and so on, till the end of time. Okay? So, in that way, it's similar, but the truth is they're not exactly the same. They are actually somewhat different. Okay? Because the Pidyon HaBen, for example, you cannot violate the Sabbath in order to fulfill the mitzvah pidyon aben. You can do it for Brit Milah, because Brit Milah must be on the 8th day, but pidyon aben should be on the 8th day. There's a difference between on the 31st day. There's a difference, therefore, between the two. Okay? Okay, so here we see the reasoning of Rabbi Yehuda, and let's see if we can figure out the reasoning of the Tanakama, of the first Tana, who came here without any attribution. Right? He says, Podeh beno, first you redeem your son, and afterwards you go up on the regal. Okay? Well, doesn't have any particular reasoning. Anyone want to speculate on what the reason could be?
Why the reason to be the 31st day? Because you can do it early in the morning and then you can make aliyah.
The problem here is the amount of money.
Danger.
The amount of money. If you only have money to do one of them, yes, well, it could be. You could go up to Jerusalem. I said that you would have expenses when you got to Jerusalem, right? Because then you have to pay up in order to buy the sacrifice. So, in truth, you could make the argument that you should go to Jerusalem without any money, because who knows what will happen once you get to Jerusalem. Okay? I mean, that's possible, that you should be able to just go and then do it. So, you should do the one that, in fact, you have to do, and the other one you can put off a little bit because it's not till a day later. And maybe things will change by the time you get there.
And there is going to be a holiday,
you know,
regularly throughout the whole year, and you'll continue to have
them.
Is that not a good
argument? No, it's true. You're right. No, that's possible. Okay, let's see what the Gemara says. The Gemara 29b2 now, Bishlama le Rabbi Yehuda. It is, we understand the reasoning of Rabbi Yehuda Kediya Martama, because the Gemara itself, the Baraita, has given us the reasoning of Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, one is a mitzvah overt, the other one is not a mitzvah overt. One mitzvah passes away, and the other one doesn't. Ela rabbanan mai tamayu. But what is the reasoning now of the rabbis? That is to say, of the non-attributed point of view, which was the first point of view of the Mishnah, which is that you do the pidyon aben first. Okay, you do the pidyon aben first. The amar kra. Kol bechor banecha tifteh. Oh, the Bible itself, the Torah itself, has the verse. The verse says, every firstborn of your sons you shall redeem. Vahadar, and then it continues on after that, Lo yera efanai rekam. My face shall not be seen empty. In other words, you shall not go empty-handed when you come to the temple. Okay? That is to say, since the Torah actually has it in a certain order, you have to do it in that order. And that then becomes the source. So it's really a textually based reason. The text says it in that order, and therefore, since the text says it in that order, it implies a hierarchy of significance in the order. That's true, by the way, for other things. I'll give you an example of one that's very, very common. You're putting on your tefillin in the morning. Okay, you take the tefillin out of the bag. And which tefillah goes first? The arm or the head? The arm goes first. So you mixed them up, or in my bag that I have my tefillin in, sometimes it's one way, sometimes it's the other way, and I can never remember which way is the top, because each one has a design on it. So sometimes the design is on one side, sometimes on the other. I can never remember which is the top. So you go in, you put your hand in, you take out the tefillah, and which is it? It's the shel rosh. Generally speaking, what we say is if you would do something like that, what you are supposed to do is that it wouldn't be nice to then say to the shel rosh, I'm sorry, wait a minute, I have to put on the other one first. So generally speaking, we would say what you touch first, you should do first, but not with tefillin. You know why? Good. No, you don't do with film. Because the Torah says, Ukshatam la'ota yadecha v'ayu letotafon b'neinecha. You shall bind them for a sign upon your arm, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. It does not say it could be this way or that way. It has a certain order that it's in the Torah. And therefore, even if you come upon one before the other, you follow the order that's in the Torah, because that's determinative. So where we do have scriptural warrant for something, that can be a significant reason, and that is exactly the case here of the Tanakhama and the Baraita. Okay?
So why do we go all the way to almost complete the Yad before we do the Rosh and then complete the Yad?
Because the custom of completing the Yad, what we do around the fingers, is all minhag. That's all
okay.
Just
that
the custom.
That's custom. There,
that the putting it on the arm right. Up here, that's not okay. Minhag. That's the Torah. But the way we wrap it around our fingers, all of that, that's our minhag. Even the way you wrap them around the arm. You'll notice Jews who do that. We had a Jew here once, Rabbi Arbiv. Some of you know, remember Rabbi Arbiv from Tel Aviv. He is an Italian Jew. Was brought up in the Italian tradition of Rome, Jews of Rome. And I remember when he came to the Minyan here, he put on his tefillin in such a way that it was a cause celebre. Nobody ever had seen anybody put tefillin on like that. He wrapped it around his arm in a way that was just so weird. So he said to him, why do you do it this way? He says, this is the minhag of the Jews of Rome. So he said, so of course the next question is, why is that the minhag of the Jews of Rome? So he says, it's Kabbalistic. And probably it was Kabbalistic, but the truth is an awful lot of this is Kabbalistic. When you do research, you find out a lot of it is Kabbalah.
You were too young for him to explain it to you?
Yeah, right, I guess so.
May I say
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In the argument that the Tanakhama makes about first you should make the Pidyon HaBen before you go up to Jerusalem, maybe there's some idea that there's a danger in bringing an unredeemed Bechor to the temple along with the other gifts that you're making of mm-hmm. firstborn animals and mm-hmm. so on. So I don't think this is realistic, but psychologically maybe it's better.
Yeah. Psychologically, maybe it's better. And psychologically also, as Bobby said before, it just seems right. Something that seems correct about it. But you're right. But nobody is to say, by the way, that you have to actually bring that son with you to Jerusalem. He's too young at that point to actually have a mitzvah of Aliyah LaRegel, okay? But I know he's your son, you want him to come, you don't want to leave him home.
the minhag of Rome must be older than nearly any other minhag of Jews except in the Holy Land.
That is correct. In most cases, right. That's true. However, where it's Kabbalistic, you never know. You just don't know.
If you haven't redeemed the child, is the child vulnerable in some way?
Is a child vulnerable? Probably not. Probably not. The child is, however, unredeemed. So the child has the mitzvah still. Every firstborn has to be redeemed. And if the firstborn is not redeemed, then there's something missing. You have to take the 5 coins, right, and pay the Kohen, and then the Kohen gives you back the child. That's what we mean by redeemed.
In other words, you buy back the baby.
Correct. From the Kohen. We discussed this last week. I don't want to review what that is. But that is the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. Okay?
But to be an unredeemed child does not prejudice your status in the community. Or does it?
I can't remember it ever having done that, but it's not good. It's not good. I mean, you could get married, you could go to school, you could do all of those things. I've never seen anything that said you couldn't do that. So in that way, it doesn't prejudice your status.
Okay, if you were not redeemed, but you don't have status.
Could you be a Kohen? You can't be a Kohen. Because the only way you can be a Kohen is if your father's a Kohen. If your father's a Kohen, you can't be redeemed. Only... You know the story about the guy who says to the rabbi, Rabbi, I want to be a Kohen. I give you the shul $10,000.
I don't hear you.
The guy comes to the rabbi and he says to the rabbi, Rabbi, I want you to make me a Kohen. I'll give the shul $10,000. Rabbi says, sorry, I can't do that. He says, Rabbi, I want you to make me a Kohen. I'll give the shul $100,000. And he says, No, I can't do that. I can't do that. So he says, Rabbi, look, this is very important to me. I'll give the shul $1,000,000. Rabbi says, all right, now, for $1,000,000, we'll make you a Kohen. But before we make you a Kohen, tell me, why do you want to be a Kohen? To spend $1,000,000 to be a Kohen? Tell me why it's so important to you. So he says, my father was a Kohen, my brother was a Kohen. So that's what you call amaratzis. This is juice. Yes.
If you covered this last week, I'm sorry. What is the modern day equivalent of redemption?
It is exactly that. You have to. We had a Pidyon HaBen in Arzarua last Sunday. A young boy was born 31 days before, and we did the Pidyon HaBen. There was a Kohen. The Kohen turned out that there was a Kohen in the family, which was okay. And they had, in this family, it was very cute, they had 5 silver dollars that the grandfather had been redeemed at his Pidyon HaBen. He had kept that. His father had kept it, and he gave it to him at his bar mitzvah. He then kept it until his own son hopefully would have a Pidyon HaBen for his son. That's what we used. So it was really, really very sweet. We had 5 silver dollars and we had the Kohen and we took the baby, and there's a whole liturgy that you read. The Kohen says, what do you prefer? Do you prefer your son or do you prefer the 5 silver dollars? And the father says, I prefer to give you the 5 silver dollars and you give me back my son. And that's, of course, what happens. First you give the Kohen and you make a switch. And it's a very sweet and a very beautiful thing to do.
And
there's always a meal served.
So and the kid is screaming.
No, this kid had such a good time.
He was
a very happy
child. $5.
Yeah. No, he was fascinated, I think, by all the attention.
Yes.
That's really what a kid likes. And so this little kid got a lot of attention. It was very sweet.
Was the mitzvah to go to the temple on the festival to make sacrifice, was that somewhat weakened in Babylonian times because it was so difficult, I guess, to do it? To go to Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
And if so, would maybe the first obligation or the redemption might have been somewhat stronger?
Mm-hmm. That's a good thought. That's if this argument were an argument of the Amoraim, that is to say, Babylonian Amoraim versus the Israeli Amoraim, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And you'll see we're going to have one of those perhaps later on tonight if we get to it. Then there would be a great argument. The problem is that this is a baraita, And the Baraita takes place entirely in the land of Israel. These are all Israelis who have these two different points of view. So it's a nice thought, but I don't know whether it was really what was functioning then. Okay, I think that that probably, as the Gemara has it, I don't see any reason to doubt the Gemara. One, the Tanakhama is following the scriptural verse, and Rabbi Yehuda is following just another type of reasoning. And it's always very interesting to weigh two conflicting mitzvot. As in many things, it's interesting as an issue of laws, an issue of philosophy. It's when you give a sermon, you will do that frequently. You'll want to put two things together and to weigh the two of them together, because if you see it one just by itself or the other just by itself, it's not in as much clarity. Yet if you put two of them together and you ask which one takes precedence, then you have to articulate some other factors that are related to these things. And so that, I think, is what you've got here. Tanu Rabbanan. Another Baraita. All right, this is always the introduction now to a Baraita, Tanu Rabbanan. Minayin she'im ayu lo chamisha banim mechamesh nashim. And this is a very basic but important question in the laws of Pidyon Aven. How do we know that if a person had five sons from five wives, right, either at the same time or consecutively? Because when you had a polygamous society, as was permissible in ancient times, you could have had five wives at once. Or, more likely, this is saying one after the other. One wife dies, or is a divorce, whatever it is. But you now set up a theoretical here, five sons and five wives. Minayin, how do we know that if you had five sons from five wives, shechayav livdot kulam, that it is his obligation, the father's obligation, to redeem all of the five sons. Okay? So it says that a father has an obligation, and you might have thought that it's just one. He has the obligation once. No, because it's peterecha mimo, the first issue of his mother's womb, the Torah says, and therefore it depends on who the mother is. And a man could have more than one wife if he's fathering children. Okay? Talmud Lamar, call Bechor Banecha Tifteh. The Torah says, call Bechor Banecha. All of your firstborn of your sons you shall redeem. So the addition of the word call, all, really covers those bases. Because it means all, because there could be a situation where there's more than one. Okay? So from that we learn. So the Gemara then says, Pshita, it's obvious. What do we need the word call for? Why does that have to say all? Why do you have to prove it that way? The whole thing is obvious. How is it obvious? Befeter rechem tala rachmana. The Torah says, peter rechem imo. That's what the Torah says in the first place. It says the first issue of the womb. So if it says the first issue of the womb, what does it mean? It means the first issue of the womb. So why do we need that to learn it from the word called? It should be obvious simply because it's the first issue of the womb. All right? Now, the answer is a good answer. Ma'u detema nelaf b'chor b'chor minachala. You might have thought that we could learn from two situations of the firstborn that there is a similarity between them, because there is another issue in law of the firstborn, and that is the issue of nachala, of inheritance. Indeed, according to the law of inheritance, the firstborn gets a double portion. According to the law of inheritance, the firstborn gets a double portion.
Firstborn of his first wife, second wife, third wife? Which wife?
So, wait a minute. Because the Torah says, Reshit Ono, the first of his strength, as it were. That is to say, the firstborn of the father. The firstborn of the father. So that when you have five wives, let's say, and each has a firstborn, who is the firstborn as far as the law of inheritance goes? The first firstborn. So you might have thought that because the Torah in both those circumstances calls the firstborn a Bechor, that you can learn from the fact that the Bechor in inheritance is the first of the firstborns, that perhaps the Bechor also, as far as Pidyon HaBen goes, is the first of the firstborns. Right? For that reason, we need something extra to teach us that is not the right way to think. What is that extra that we are taught? Kol Bechor. The Torah has to add the word kol in order to deal with that possibility that you might have thought otherwise.
On the first peter imo, it's the same as kol.
What do you mean?
Peter lechem imo,
yeah.
That's the firstborn of that woman.
Right.
So that's the same as kol for every of the guys.
No, but you might have said if it just said peter lechem imo, that it could be the first wife, emo meaning the first wife. Why would you have ever thought that? Because we have another law. We have the law of inheritance. And in a law of inheritance, because the Torah says, Reishit Ono, the first of his strength, the beginning of his strength, that we learn from one situation about the other situation. Because the Torah says, Kol Bechor Banecha, we learn that in fact the two situations are different. Okay?
So it's the firstborn of the first wife.
Who? Gets what?
Hmm?
Who gets what?
The primogeniture, in other words.
As far as the law of inheritance, is the firstborn of the first wife. But as far as the law of Pidyon HaBen,
it's the firstborn of any of the wives, whoever's the first
wife may not have any.
Yes, that's correct. That's a good point. That's right. What they say is correct. It's the firstborn of any of the wives, because it doesn't really matter whether it's the first wife or the tenth wife. Okay, whoever has the firstborn, that's the key thing. You're right.
Now, wait a minute. The firstborn, boy?
Boy. Only boys have a Pidyon HaBen. Okay? Absolutely. Only boys. Yes.
If a woman has a child and then her husband dies and she remarries and her second child is the first...
Of that husband.
Does that second child inherit... That child does not require a Pidyon HaBen. But would they inherit from the father?
Would they inherit from which father? From his own father?
Yeah.
From the second husband, yes. The child who is the child of the second husband inherits the second husband. The child who is the child of the first husband, in fact, still inherits the first husband. Okay? So when he dies, whatever is left in his estate, if there's anything in his estate, will go to his son, not to the other sons. Okay?
What happens if the firstborn to the father is a Pilegish?
If the firstborn to the father is a Pilegish, does she inherit? Is that the question?
No, first of all, it is the Pidyon HaBen.
Oh, you're talking Pidyon HaBen.
So the
Pidyon HaBen. If the mother of the firstborn is a Pilegish, doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference. She's still, correct, as long as she's Jewish, she still has to have a Pidyon HaBen. Unless this Pilegish is a concubine. Unless this Pilegish is a Kohen or a Levi. Keep that in mind too here, that we saw last time, that as far as the laws of Pidyon HaBen go, if either the father or the mother is a Kohen or a Levi, there's no Pidyon HaBen. So keep that in mind, that disqualifies people who you might or not have thought of otherwise. Okay? Now, all this goes back to the verses we examined last time, which filled out for us and we went into a long discussion of the history of Pidyon HaBen and of the nature of the firstborn in the Torah. We went through a whole lot of sources about the nature of the firstborn in the Torah, and I tried to show you the way in which that developed and how the Torah had a sort of a counterintuitive reaction to the firstborn, even as far as the firstborn of the Pidyon HaBen goes. Yes?
Does this have any relationship to Isaac and to animals, you know, male, perfect animal sacrifices? Is this ensuring that there's no sacrifice of children?
It's not ensuring that there's no sacrifice of children, but I did point out last week that, in fact, the place of the firstborn should be seen partly in the context of a world in which firstborns were in fact sacrificed. That in Israel, the firstborn is dealt with entirely differently. It's dealt with historically. Since the firstborn was saved at Egypt, the Egyptians were slain, and the firstborn of the Jews were slain. Therefore, the firstborn has a certain status. Yet that then conflicts then with the status of the Levium. Right? The Levium who were rewarded for not worshipping the golden calf by then becoming the priestly class, which required then the redemption of the firstborn, who otherwise would have been first in this hierarchy. Okay? That, in a nutshell, is the history of the Pidyon HaBen.
But if the whole purpose of the Kohanim and the Levites and the firstborn was to serve the temple in Jerusalem, and the temple is no longer in existence, why then do we follow this custom? Why mm-hmm. why would this custom not come back if, as and when, the temple is rebuilt?
Mm-hmm. Because the context of the law is that this is something you shall do throughout all your generations. So that one could see it as a zecher lemikdash, as a way of remembering the temple. But from a legal perspective, that's not even necessary, because simply it is placed in the context of an eternal statute that you have. Once it's an eternal statute, just simply it is an eternal statute. The reality is that what happens is that we become conscious of this whole area of Jewish life, which is separate. It is this, we talked about that last week too, the separateness of the Jews. That the Jews are separate, and that the Jews have separate space, and that separate space is part of what our notion of the sacred is. That there is a kodesh v'chol, there is a holy and there is a profane. There are some places that are more holy than other places. All of this is a very peculiar but very truly Jewish way of dealing with holiness. So that one of the realities of having this consciousness is almost the portability of such religious concepts. They become portable. Judaism really defines for us a notion of God's presence where there are different levels of status, having to do frequently with place. The fact that we can be all over the place, even when there's no temple, and still have access to such religious experience is partly the result of laws like this of Pidyon HaBen. Okay? So in a way they become eternal laws and preserve for us what otherwise couldn't have been preserved. That was what we were talking about last week with this fellow Singer's book on the nature of place, the relation of architecture to holiness of space.
Okay? Of course this preceded the Beit HaMikdash anyways, but did this technically, is the placement in Torah, does this begin before the Mishkan is built?
No, this begins
after.
Well, this, the truth, remember the very beginning of this discussion is in chapter 12 and 13 of the book of Exodus.
Right,
so that's before the Mishkan. That's before the Mishkan. However, chapter 12 and 13 of Exodus is the Exodus itself, slaying of the firstborn, then the Exodus, and then Kadesh li kol b'chor, sanctify me for me every firstborn. That's already chapter 12 of Exodus. That's before the building of any holy space, which is not till somewhat later in the Torah. Not a lot later, but somewhat later. Okay? So, but that's not Pidyon HaBen. That's the firstborn who is required to be sacred in the sacred space. Pidyon HaBen doesn't enter into this until the book of Numbers, really. Although reference is made, and there the Torah says, when you enter the land, right? That was the context that the Torah speaks in Exodus 13. When you enter the land. So that down the road now, things are going to change. Okay? Back to the text.
May I ask a question? Did they have, in that society, did they have multiple wives? They did, right?
What does that society mean?
Multiple.
What is that
society? What are we talking about here?
What society is that? That's about 1,000 years. Be talking about In a thousand years, you get a lot of variation. Okay? I'm talking about a thousand years. Where am I getting a thousand years from? This, the giving of the Torah is roughly 1300 BCE. Okay? The beginning of the rabbinic period is at its earliest about a thousand years later. Okay? And that period itself lasts about 800 years. So add the two of them together, you have almost 2,000 years. So, yes, in the Torah, we know that in the Torah there was a polygamous society. Because the Torah sets up the whole structure for the thing. Right? We have some evidence that, we know about some people. We have stories about people in the Torah, but we don't have a lot of them. So we have some evidence from the narrative portions of the Torah about what was done. In rabbinic times, it seems that it was very rarely polygamous. But in a way, that didn't matter as far as the discussions of the law go, because these discussions take place on their own basis. If the law permits polygamy, then we discuss polygamy. Okay? Realize that polygamy was practiced in the Jewish community until late 50s, early 60s, and there was the famous case. It was a major case in Zionism. The Ashkenazi communities outlawed polygamy in the 10th century.
The Yemenites and the Moroccans.
That's what I'm going to. The Yemenites, the Ashkenazim outlawed it in the 10th century. So that's 1,000 years ago, 1,100 years ago. That's a long time. Which is not to say that it was done even then or before then. Because, again, from the Talmud, it appears that these things didn't happen. Don't have a lot of evidence, but where you do have evidence, and we'll see some of that shortly, we see no stories about rabbis having more than one wife. So, to the extent that one can infer from this certain things, it seems it wasn't done. That having been said, it wasn't outlawed as far as the Ashkenazim are concerned until the 10th century. However, that was an Ashkenazi phenomenon. In those days, you didn't have the internet. Okay, you didn't have constant contact between Jewish communities. You had some contact, but you also had certain variations of practice. And in fact, rabbinic authorities in Germany were not rabbinic authorities in North Africa. And if they were in North Africa, and even if you had some contact between those communities, you had much less contact when you got to Saudi Arabia, where, of course, your Yemenite community was. So the issue that was the issue in the 50s was the result of Operation Magic Carpet, Marvadak Samim. The magic carpet, when the Yemenite Jews came, they came to Israel, and it turned out that a number of them were polygamous. And the state decided then, as did the chief rabbinate, and everyone was of one mind, there was no issue there, that if you came with more than one wife, you could keep that. But once you're in the state of Israel, polygamy is prohibited.
Ethiopian Jews had the same issue.
They had the same issue?
Very few, but because they were poor in general.
Yeah, generally speaking, polygamy is only possible when you have a lot of money.
Right.
It's a very expensive thing to do.
Under the British, there was a law that if you come from a polygamous society and you bring with you one or two wives, more than one wife, it was that they were permitted to maintain it, but to establish a polygamous marriage, so to speak, was not permitted. So the Yemenite Jews came still under the British. They didn't wait till the state was established.
No, they didn't. The Yemenite Jews came in 1950.
Yes.
So, but the British were out in 1948. 1948, the British were out.
I remember when we had in Israel, before Israel.
No, but the project to bring them was in 50.
The Marvadak Samim.
Marvadak Samim.
Wait, when you had a mass exodus, that was 1950.
Yes, but they
But before then, I'm sure you had individuals who came. No doubt about it. I'm sure you must have done that. Okay.
Can I ask a question? We were talking before about Pidyon HaBen in a context of reminding us of the time of the temple, but we preserve the priesthood, many places we still have Birkat Kohanim, and quite a lot. Is there an element in there that we want to be prepared when perhaps the temple is rebuilt, so we will not have, we need to have...
Definitely that is an element. Definitely that is an element. I was simply arguing that that's not the only element. Frequently it's argued that that is the only reason to do it. I'm arguing that there is an element of memory, which may or may not have practical consequences. That memory is relevant, zecher lemikdash, to remember how things were. And then even beyond that, that our whole ability to conceive of God in terms of this, the space and the separations, which are very basic to Judaism, is most centrally understood once we deal with this, with the element of space in Jerusalem. And that, that sets up a whole construct of thought which involves holy and profane places. And that's very basic to Judaism. But Judaism is a faith that also goes beyond that and enables you to make those things portable. Kashrut, for example. And last week I explained the laws of Kashrut are laws that in Parshat Shmini speak of Tamei v'Tahor. The non-kosher animal is an animal that is Tamei. Technically speaking, Tamei makes no sense outside of the temple. You have to have a holy space for something to be impure. The only way it can make it, its relevance is to temple. Right? But that doesn't matter, because it becomes a portable idea. It becomes a portable idea, and therefore the idea of the forbidden and the permissible in terms of how we eat, how we relate to ourselves, all of that is part of the portability of these concepts. Okay? And so I'm just going beyond the practical. I'm adding another level of the practical.
Well, I'm not sure it's practical. Should we be thinking in those terms?
Oh, I can tell you when in the 1920s and 30s, when Zionism was really gaining a hold for the first time really on the religious community, I realized that the religious community was by and large not supportive of Zionism because it was seen as an atheistic movement by Jews who had rejected religious faith. So the rabbis of the Yishuv, there's great tension between the rabbis of the Yishuv and the leaders of the Yishuv. The one who began to overcome that was Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of what was then Palestine. He became the chief rabbi of Jaffa just around the time of World War I. And eventually, after the establishment of the mandate, Rav Kook was appointed by the British, together with, of course, it was the leadership of the Jews in Palestine that appointed him the first rabbi, the first chief rabbi. So Rav Kook then set up the study of the laws of sacrifices. And it was a major piece of the rabbinic curriculum to study the laws of sacrifices. Why?
To get ready.
Because the notion of Zionism here is a messianic redemption and a rebuilding of the temple. And this is still something that goes on in a number of places in Israel today, where there is always a piece of the curriculum that is devoted to the study of sacrifices. I frankly am supportive of this. I think it's a very good idea. That's part of a certain type of Zionism, which believes that the classic laws have to come back, and we have to reestablish classic law. And among the things that has to be studied now are the laws of sacrifices.
We keep the altar in our kitchen and dining room.
Correct. That's another example of portability. It's a very good example of the portability of an idea of the altar. That in fact the altar is now the table. It is the dining table. And the activities of some of the sacrifices are activity. We put salt on the bread because the sacrifice was salted. So these are portable ideas. Again, is it only Zecher LeMikdash? Is it only for the reestablishment of the temple? Well, it's both of them, but I'm arguing that it's beyond that. It creates a portable reality of religious experience, which wouldn't exist had the temple not been there, but which continues to exist to some extent because of this notion of portability.
But because of that, it would make it very difficult for some people, personally, to go back to an ancient classical system.
It would both
we've appropriated.
Correct.
That.
It would both make it difficult and possible. You're right. You're right. There's no doubt. Yeah. Because just think of the alternative. Let's say you didn't have any such portability. You didn't have any such consciousness. The Jews in Lithuania and in Los Angeles and in Palm Beach and on the Upper East Side of Manhattan wouldn't have been dealing with categories like that. Would it be more or less likely that they could ever exist? I think it would be less likely. Because the truth is, here we are sitting in 2008 discussing things which now have a certain reality to them, simply because we're discussing them. They're live to us. This is real stuff. This is real stuff. So I think that, yes, it can go both ways.
If you look in Sim Shalom, it gives you two alternatives.
Yeah, right. Conservative movement is not sure how to react to this.
Right.
There's some who say, it's finished, it's over, we're embarrassed by the whole thing.
Right.
And then the more traditionalists.
It would have been interesting to have a record of the debates that went into that.
Absolutely.
Decision.
Somebody should write that. In your next career, Barry. Do a little bit of historical research, it would be fascinating to see. I think it would reveal a great deal.
This is really the historical reality.
You bet. You bet. You bet. Okay, we go on. We go on. Now, we finished the discussion now of Pidyon HaBen, and we are going to now deal with the next piece of the Baraita, which was Lilamdo Torah. The father is required to teach his son Torah. He is required to teach his son Torah. So the first thing that the Gemara asks, this is now on the right side of 29b2, the top. Minalan, how do we know that a father is required to teach his son Torah? Dichtid, vilimadetem otam et benechem. Because the Torah says, and this is in the second paragraph of the Shema, and you shall teach them to your sons. Okay? So, vilimadetem otam, you shall teach them, namely the mitzvot. You shall teach the mitzvot, you shall teach the Torah to your sons. Very important possibility that is raised here. And in the case where the father has not taught the son. Okay? Here, a father has not taught the son. Michayiv ihu lemigmar nafshe. He is required to teach himself. Very important idea here.
Yeah, really
the son is required to teach himself. Okay, the father has the obligation first of teaching the son. If the father does not fulfill that obligation, because we've seen this both in Brit Milah
and the
Pidyon HaBen, we had to raise in both of these cases, what happens if the father doesn't do what he's supposed to do? Okay? Michayev ihu lemigmar nafshe, he is obligated to teach himself. Dichtiv ulemadetem, because the Torah also says, and you shall learn.
That sounds amazing.
You shall learn.
That's great.
That's very important. That's very important for ever so many people. In fact, they could not face, you know, they didn't learn because they didn't come from families where these things were done. So, you know, we just take this for granted and we say, well, if it didn't happen, didn't happen. I didn't have a mazel or a mazel or lack of mazel, whatever, however you interpret it. And I never learned these things. My family wasn't done. But the truth is, you have the obligation yourself. Every Jew has that obligation. We frequently think of it simply as the community's obligation. Community is obligated to take care of the parent, the father, the parent is obligated. If that's not the case, the community is obligated. Bottom line here is that it's an individual's obligation. It's an individual. Ulamadetem. You shall learn, the Torah says. Okay? So it's both you shall teach yourself and you shall learn independently. She, namely the mother, how do we know that the mother is not obligated to teach the son? That's an interesting question here. Okay? Because we said in the Baraita is all the obligations of the father to the son. So why shouldn't this be an obligation of the mother to teach the son? Right? Listen to the answer. Dichtiv vilimadetem ulamadetem. We said that there are two words. One, you shall teach. And the other one, you shall learn. Right? Both of them. They're both parts of the requirement here. You shall teach and you shall learn. You shall teach your son. You shall learn yourself. But look at the way they're written. Vilimadetem and ulamadetem are written exactly the same way. The vowels are different. But think about the vowels that are in the Torah. What are the vowels in the Torah? There are no vowels in the Torah. Simply are no vowels in the Torah. Okay? So in other words...
They're reading the same word two different ways.
Correct. The same well, they, no, no, no. These are two different verses.
They are two different verses.
And we have a tradition about how to read them. We have a tradition about how to read them. But the truth is that when you look at them, they're exactly the same. In rabbinic exegesis, frequently... If that is the case, then there is something that you can be learned about these two different categories. They have somehow a connection, one with the other, that is a compelling connection. So the rabbis will try to articulate what that is. Okay. Now it says, "Kol shemitzuvel ilmod," everyone who is obligated to learn, mitzuvel ilamet, is required to teach. And whoever is not obligated to learn is not obligated to teach. Of course, here the assumption is that since a woman is not required to study the Torah herself, she is obligated, therefore not obligated, to teach her son. Now that is, it assumes what I just said, that a woman is not obligated to study the Torah. So then we go on. From where do we know that a woman is not obligated to teach herself Torah? That's certainly not intuitive for a modern audience. Okay, it's the last thing we would ever think. For the more classic audience, you'll see it's an interesting subject. But the Gemara asks... how do we know that a woman is not obligated to teach herself? Dichtiv limadetem ulamadetem. Because these two words are connected to one another. Kol sha'acherim mitzuvim lelamdo. All that others are required to teach, mitzuvel lelamed atzmo, is required to teach himself. V'chol she'en acherim mitzuvim lelamdo. And whoever is not commanded to teach, ein mitzuvel lelamed et atzmo, is not commanded to teach himself. But of course there's an assumption there. Uminayin she'en acherim mitzuvim lelamda, how do we know that others are not required to teach her? Dichtiv, diamakra, because the Torah says, vilimadetem otam et benechem, you shall teach your sons, velo benotachem. Says Binechem, your sons, that implies not your daughters.
So what happens when the husband dies and the wife is left with the son?
Yeah, the son is obligated to teach himself.
Well, suppose the son is 9 years old and...
So when he will grow up?
That's not...
No, if the question is whether... It's a good question. In fact, how does the father fulfill the obligation? What does it mean to have an obligation? Does it mean that you actually teach the child? In fact, what it means is that you have to be responsible for the fact that the child is taught. What does it mean to be responsible for the fact that the child is taught? To pay somebody, not just to get.
You pay.
You pay. You are obligated to pay. Therefore, you have an essential financial obligation. The assumption being, who is making the money, the mother or the father?
the father.
The father, the assumption is. The assumption is that the father is making the money. The father, therefore, the question is, what does a father have to spend his money on? In fact, if he says, no, I want to spend my money on my wives. I want to spend my money on my stereos. I want to spend my money on my cars and my football games. The first thing you have to do is spend your money to make sure your son studies the Torah. Okay? So that's the key thing here, is that there is this obligation of spending money. And in fact, in most cases, the father doesn't teach. What the father does is spend the money to make sure that the child is taught by others.
How would you say your children rather than your sons?
There are a few ways you could do it. You could say b'neichem u'benotechem.
And it says here what?
B'neichem. You could say your...
So how do we know that this doesn't say your children, which includes both the sons and the daughters?
We don't. We don't know that.
Well, I think it does.
Well, you don't know that. No, you want it to say that. But you have to bring me evidence. No, you have to show me other places where it does, where the word b'neichem, in fact, legally, not in a narrative, but in a legal context, where it could mean both. Generally, that's not a legal context. The legal context, b'nei Yisrael, is no legal context. In every context where we are dealing with a mitzvah, we have to look and see what the language is. We have to look and see what the language is. It's not just general language. In fact, the language is very specific. We're dealing with a law book here. And it could be that you will have other evidence, but you've got to bring your evidence. Okay? It's not just what you wanted to think. It depends on the way in which these things are construed in the legal tradition. Okay? And the way in which something is construed gives it its meaning. Okay?
We saw here that the woman has less mitzvot or less obligation in the last few things, the last two lessons. So when this concept of a Jewish kid is, if the mother is Jewish, the kid is Jewish. The woman has less Jewish mitzvot or less Jewish obligations. Where it was developed?
I don't want to deal with that yet, because that, when we get further on, I think we can be more reflective. We'll have more evidence to deal with it. Let's deal with the specifics of the case in front of us now. I think that, Bobby, behind your effort there is a very reasonable cause.
Well, we've been talking about the grammar of Matatem, and you know exactly what the meaning is depending on the grammar and the structure of it. So it is reasonable to do that. I didn't know that there's other instances where this is consistently, you know, meaning only boys, but the translation of it can be children if there's only one child.
Correct. It's possible. That's possible.
This is the birth of tuition.
Definitely the birth of tuition, no doubt about that. But I think that the underlying sense that one has here is that why would it be that women would not be obligated? Isn't that odd?
You need to teach the children.
I would say,
well,
what if her husband dies?
No, forget her husband.
Women to learn.
Just women to learn. Women to learn. To assume that women should not learn. Now, first of all, to put it in a general context, realize that the idea that women should vote is in the history of the world a relatively new concept. It's not 100 years old.
Right.
So it's not so odd if one looks at history. And obviously the status of women was vastly different than some of the things that we take for granted in this modern society. Okay? In modern society, I think it is assumed that women, of course, should learn. Why should women learn? What would be the reasoning? Why would women learn?
To be compatible in the family.
For the sake of the family, maybe.
But they
I mean, because I could make the other argument too.
But it doesn't
make the opposite argument.
And they were very good observers, and they knew that the women transmit the values in the family to the children. I'm going to take the position that they just assumed it.
Uh huh.
that in fact the learning of the children, anybody who knows that when a man goes and is a laborer in whatever all day and the children are with the mother, who's teaching?
Okay, so if I could articulate, just take that a little bit further. Let's say this point of view would say, well, it says that you shall teach them, meaning the boys, and meaning that the father should do it because of the following. Number one, because you have to say it. With the mother, you don't have to say it.
Yeah,
you simply don't have to say it. You don't have to say it. Because it's so obvious.
Right.
What is a mother doing except, of course, she's doing it all the time.
She's teaching the children.
The father, one might argue, though, he has a conflict. What is his conflict? His conflict is that he's not in the house.
Right.
He's not involved with the children.
Right.
And so, therefore, you have to require him to do something, or else it simply might not get done.
That's my position.
Okay? So, all right. That's a very, very good position. I'm trying to tease out some possibilities here. Okay?
This just strikes me as a dangerous precedent if we're going to be consistent, because clearly there's a great deal commanded in the Torah that must apply to men and women. And if we're suggesting that the Torah is sort of geared toward men, then that would, in theory, make it legal for women to murder or steal or do all the other things that clearly apply to everyone. So I can't really buy the fact that the Torah is geared toward men, and therefore when women aren't commanded to do something, it's because it's simply understood that they would know otherwise.
But what if we, and to answer your possibility there, let's say that we could show legally that women are obligated not to murder. Really quite simple, because we have the general principle here, which we read about in the Mishnah, that women are obligated with all the mitzvot lo taseh, every negative commandment a woman is obligated for. What we are dealing with now are positive commandments. And remember, we had a positive commandment, we had a structure of positive commandments, so two types of positive commandments. One is a positive commandment, mitzvah taseh shazman grama, positive commandment which is governed by time, and the other is a positive commandment which is not governed by time. The positive commandments governed by time, we saw that, at least in the Mishnah, the women were free from. Okay.
But that proves the point, because the woman couldn't possibly be expected to follow a commandment she didn't understand. So she must have been taught enough to mm-hmm. know at least the negative mm-hmm. commandments,
okay.
Otherwise she wouldn't be covered by the law.
But
okay.
It's catch-22. It's like, if she's not obligated to learn by herself or to teach, who taught her? I mean...
I'll give you an answer to that. Maybe our whole concept of teaching is very external and almost male.
Yeah.
Right.
That in fact, real teaching doesn't go on in schools. If you haven't really learned outside of the school, you know, we have a concept of teaching, let's say teaching the Torah in school. Truth is that maybe that's not the best place to teach the Torah. Maybe the Torah really should be taught at home. And it's only where the home has failed that you have a school. And the school has to take the place of in loco parentis. But it's really the parentis that has the job to do. Okay? So we're dealing with a reality that's so separate from this simply because our families have lost their function. But maybe that didn't exist. Maybe they still had their functions alive and well then. Henry, you had your hand up.
One possibility that occurs to me is that Torah is a deep reservoir of potential knowledge, and that once you get into it, you really have to plunge and stick with it and spend almost all your time doing it, and
mm-hmm.
that women.
This is important.
Limited,
what Andrew is saying.
Limited set of responsibilities for which clearly they have to learn those things
mm-hmm.
for which they're.
This is very important. What Henry is saying, because our concept of Torah here is also almost a secular concept and a very practical one, and the analogies that we make are to the other types of learning that we do. If you think of Torah almost as the format of, I'll use a sort of mystical term of an adept. Mm-hmm. An adept, that's a mystical term for people who are trained. Trained to have a great deal of religious experience. Catholic Church, for example, you have monks. in the Buddhist tradition. You have monks, you have children. The children are sent away from the house to be in a certain community. They tend to be male communities, those communities. And it's a full time and a half experience to be involved in that kind of learning. And maybe then the only people you can require that of are the people, in fact, who have that flexibility. And that's only one, that's only 50% of the population, because otherwise the whole population, the whole society will be destroyed. You can't have people going off into the countryside studying, leaving their families. It's a real problem. And you will see, in fact, the next subject in the Gemara is exactly this issue. It's exactly this issue when you have a conflict between marriage and study of Torah. Because that's really what's implied here too. Are we talking about the study of Torah? We're talking about the study of Torah that really requires time and money. Time and money. Can you obligate everyone for that?
What is the obligation to teach your sons? Like, how much Torah, like,
it's a good question.
To teach them in order to
it's a good question. And it's a very good question, and it's a hard question. But let me just further define the question without really answering it. I'll define the question, first of all, in terms of several types of Torah. There really are two types to begin with. One type is the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. Because when the Torah itself says, and you shall teach them to your children, I would assume the first thing that it has in mind is itself. Right? It's that. But we know that the Torah is much more than that. The Torah is also the Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's the oral tradition. So, question number two is, if we would even assume that what we mean by you shall teach them involves the written Torah, next question is, well, how about the oral Torah? Is that also required? Okay? I'm not going to answer these questions, but I just think it's a good question to ask. Because it's going to come down also in the question of women, we'll see shortly. Carol?
Well, when it says not required and not responsible, does that imply that there is a prohibition?
That's a good question. That's a good question. We don't know yet. It might or it might not. And you know what? There are some who say it might and it might not.
But I mean, those words don't, to me, it's still an open...
That's how it is to you. I'm glad that that's that way to you. But it's not the only possibility. Because
but it does sort of give a prejudice.
Like, correct.
Not required, not responsible. So why, boss, kind of why?
Exactly. Friends, what I would like to do now is just give you a little bit of the history of this discussion.
Okay.
And show you, in fact, some of the ways in which this is dealt with. Again, I want you to see the way in which problems which are on the one hand, social problems, familial problems, problems of status, and problems that, in fact, are very relevant to us as a society that is really searching for the nature of roles of men and women. And we haven't finished this yet. We're a work in progress, I think. Realize that these discussions will frequently turn on certain texts. And the process of reading text is not a simple process. And what you just said now, Carol, that's right. When you read a text, does it mean when it says that you're not required, does that mean that you can or does it mean that you can't?
That you shouldn't.
Or that you shouldn't, exactly. Well, the very fact that you have a textual tradition will leave you with questions like that. And the likelihood is that some people will say one thing and some people will say the other thing. Also, you want to know, are there any other texts that might influence the discussion? Because, in fact, if there are other texts, then it either complicates or it simplifies the issue. There happens to be, in this case, some other texts. Let me read you some other texts. Contemporaneous texts, which are not easy texts either, but texts that we have to know in order to be able to flesh out this discussion. The Mishnah in Masechet Sotah. There's a tractate of Sotah. The Sotah, you remember, is Sotah. The Sota is a man suspects his wife of being unfaithful. Right? There is no proof that she's unfaithful, but he suspects that she has had some sort of relation with another man. He accuses her of this. He makes her life miserable because of it. Right? And now, there's always a very great problem whenever we read this in the Torah. People say, how could you ever have such a thing? All I can tell you is that currently, I'm dealing with two such cases. Of men who are just about ready to kill their wives. The wives who say, I didn't do anything. The jealous husband is a theme of literature, and in fact, one meets them. It happens. So that's the subject of the sutta. Okay? So the man suspects his wife. The Torah has a very strange ritual. She comes, she's brought to the temple. She has to, the Torah gives you a text. That text is mixed with water. I write out the text. It's then scraped off into the water, and she then drinks the water. If she drinks the water and she's guilty, her bowels will distend and she will become terribly ill, and it's the worst thing. It's a trial by fire kind of thing. It's a trial by ordeal. And if she's innocent, then everything will be fine. And then the husband, he gets punished. Okay? She's made her crazy. So that's the subject of the sutta. It's a whole tractate of the Talmud, which is one of the most extraordinary tractates of the Talmud. The tractate of Sotah, in my opinion, is one of the great pieces of Western literature. Nobody can read it because it's so controversial, it's so politically incorrect that I could never teach in the seminary because they would kill me first. I'd be run out, stone dead before I'd have a chance to get to the end of the first chapter. But if only people could get beyond that, I'm telling you, someday, mark my word, one of the great, great pieces of Western literature. So in the Masechet Sotah, the third chapter, the fourth Mishnah reads like that. Eina maspeket lishtot. She drinks the waters of the Sotah. She doesn't even get them down. Eina maspeket lishtot means she doesn't even get them down. In other words, one, two, three, after she drinks these waters. Ad shepaneha morikot. Assuming now that she's guilty, her face turns green. All right? Paneha morikot.
What did they put in the water?
She's guilty. This is she's in the temple. She's in the temple. She has committed adultery, and adultery. The Torah is not very happy with adulterers. Anybody who commits adultery, you know what the penalty for adultery is?
Death.
Death by stoning. Okay. So in this case, but there's no proof in this case. Problem is a problem of proof. The guy has no proof, but the problem is maybe he's just a jealous husband. And he's driving her crazy. These husbands exist. I told you. It's life. Okay? Eina maspeket lishtot ad shepaneha morikot ve'ineha boltot. Her eyes start popping out. Ve'hi mitmalet gidin. And her veins begin to project. Okay? Ve'hem omrim. And the Kohanim who are around there say, Hotzi'uha, Hotzi'uha, Shelo titma ha'azara. Get her out of here, get her out of here, so that she not defile the holy space. Okay, she's going to die. And there's going to be blood all over the place. It's going to be a real problem. Im yesh la zechut. It's a very interesting problem. So she's guilty in this case. Now, it's not to say that everybody who drinks the waters is guilty, but this woman who drank the waters was guilty. But there's a problem here. What if she was also a good guy? And she did a lot of mitzvahs. All right? She used to take care. She took, you know the story about the guy who stole from everybody, but he was good to his mother. It's always true. Terrible people, they commit murders and everything. Let's go to his mother. His mother, she was in her old age, and he stole from everybody, but he took care of his mother. and his mother was sick, he took her to the doctor. That kind of. So here, this woman, she's an adulteress.
She's an adulteress.
But, and she's going through this process now that's proving it. It's a miraculous thing. Talmud says, by the way, it can never happen again. This is only something that could happen in the time of the Torah when everybody's heart was pure and true. It says that what happened was, by the time you get to the rabbinic times, husbands began to also do things like that. You couldn't trust anybody. And therefore, the law became null and void, and it was no longer possible to prosecute them. As soon as it was clear the men were also doing it, then the law lost all of its validity. Okay, so practically speaking, there is no law of the Sota. It's impossible. Even if there were a temple, in the time of the temple, they outlawed the law of the Sota because of what I just said to you. So anyway, so let's say she's a good guy. She's a good woman. She took care of her mother. She had mitzvahs to her credit. Im yesh la zechut, if she has merits on her side, tolala, it would put off the reckoning. Because here, realize what could happen. She drinks the waters, and she's okay. But she was an adulterer. How could it be that she was an adulterer and this wouldn't destroy her? Well, what if she had mitzvahs? So if she drinks the waters and she's okay, could be because of some of the mitzvahs that she did. So some, if you do some mitzvah, tolala, it can put off the punishment. Yesh zechut tola shana achat. Some merit can put this off for a year. Yesh zechut tola shtei shani. There are some things that a person could do that could put it off for 2 years.
Are you talking about the reaction?
The reaction, right.
2 years later?
Right, 2 years from now. So the reality is, we expect that this whole thing is going to be instantaneous, that it's, what did you call it, a trial by?
Ordeal.
So a trial by, there's a problem with a trial by ordeal. Because even the trial by ordeal is not so clear. Yesh zechut tola shalosh shanim. There are 3 years.
You're watching her for 3 years.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, but she's still under a cloud of suspicion.
This is a problem. Okay? It's a problem in many ways. Because what about this woman who knows she has been an adulterer? Okay? And then she sees that this doesn't work. So she has a few thoughts. One thought is, this whole system is stupid. I got away with it. All you got to do is smile. deny it. Right? Because reasonably she could think that too. Right? When, you know, it doesn't even occur to her that maybe she's being paid back now for the few good deeds that she did do. Because, you know, people are mixed bags. Maybe she was a mixed bag, this lady. Mikan Omer Ben Azai. From here, Ben Azai says, Chayav Adam Lelamed et Bito Torah. From here we learn that a person is obligated to teach his daughter Torah. No. Wait. Well, it could be. Here, one possibility, second possibility. All right. You said, Robert, what did you say again?
If from this we learn you should teach your daughter Torah, it means she could accumulate mitzvot by studying Torah.
Okay, and what did you say?
I think I said the same thing.
Oh, you said the same? Oh, another thing is, she could accumulate these things in order to... Well, is it a good thing or a bad thing? The teaching of the Torah.
Well,
no,
but eventually...
If it's being used to get away with,
then it's not so good.
It's not so good.
She's not getting away with a terrible deed. She's not allowed to do that, right? So, but there must be something that he thinks is good. Well, the commentators say that what he is in effect saying, Rashi's understanding of this is that he is saying that it's important because she's going to doubt the validity of faith and of the system of the Torah. She's going to doubt the validity of the Torah. Because after all, she went through the RDO, and it doesn't do anything. Only if she has studied Torah, she realizes that in fact there is a system of reward and punishment here. Only if she has a larger context in which to put this, then she will understand that you don't get away with anything. And indeed, you are paid back for your good deeds in certain ways, but you, in the long run, really won't be getting away for anything. Therefore, it's important to teach. That's what Ben Azai says. Okay? Omer Ben Azai, Chayav Adam Lelamed Et Bito Torah. She'im Tishte Teda Shehazechut Tolala. She will then know that if she drinks and nothing happens to her, that it's because of the merit that she had performed. In fact, she has a larger context, which is a religious context that she can bring to this thing. Okay? Listen to this now. Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer says, Kol amilamed bito Torah ki'ilu lomda tiflut. Whoever teaches his daughter Torah, it is as if he is teaching her tiflut. Now, tiflut is a very difficult word. As in any textual tradition here, part of it is dependent upon what the word means. And we don't know what that word means.
No taste.
Something is tafel. What is it in modern
Hebrew?
No taste. Tefel. What does it mean? What does it mean if it's tafel?
Tafel has no taste.
It's negative.
Land?
No, like if you eat something and it has no taste.
Flavorless.
Doesn't mean that in this context. It may mean, what did you say, Vince?
Negative.
It could mean negative.
Without character.
Could be without character. That could be. Teaches a tiflut, in other words, she can't learn this. That's a possibility. Maybe it means that. Could mean something actually much worse than that. Tiflut could mean that you're leading her astray.
If you teach a woman Torah,
that you're leading her astray.
Why?
Well, it could be a number of reasons. One, you could she could want to be in the company of those who, in fact, do spend their time studying the Torah.
Raise the expectations.
Oh, you raise expectations. But the key thing here is not just raise expectations for the study of Torah. That she will fool around. She'll be sleeping with the guys. The guys want a woman. Why do the guys want a woman? They want to sleep with her. Okay, so she's hanging around with the guys. She will be tempted into all kinds of illicit behavior that she shouldn't have. I'm not saying that that's what it means. I'm saying that this word tiflut is difficult. But it's opening up a whole variety of negative possibilities here. Okay? Now, the key thing is that we have two points of view. Ben Azai says, you have to teach your daughter Torah. He gives a certain justification in this context of the Sota. And Rabbi Eliezer has exactly the opposite point of view. Okay? So, you see that there is a context, even within the Mishnah itself, where the subject of women's studying is brought up, and where we have two different points of view. I'll give you another source now. Yes, Gail?
Well, no, I was just going to comment that today, you know, in the contemporary world, in the third world countries, and especially in the Arab countries, it's a fight to the death for women to learn to read.
That's why I want to show you that in this tradition, it's much more complicated. Because even though you had a source that could lead you in that direction, you can have other sources that are going to be in opposition to each other. As here, for example, we have a Mishnaic source, which goes in two opposite directions. And we're going to therefore have to deal with other sources to see where they go. And then eventually we're going to have to figure out why the sources say what they say. In fact, I see that no sooner do you begin this discussion than our time has run out. And therefore we will pick this up with the next source. I'll briefly, unfortunately, the people who were not here tonight will want to know all about that Mishnah and Sotah, but as you can see, it's a complicated Mishnah, and I don't want to start from it again, so we'll have them make sure that they listen to the Or Zaruah website, where you can always hear the class that you were not present for.
And it's very clear. It's very well done.
Okay, you did it last week?
Yeah.
Great. That's true. Next week, there is no class. Thank you for reminding me. No class next week. It is the eve of Thanksgiving. I'm going to Israel, God willing, on Sunday. and we'll be back the following week. So next class in 2 weeks.